From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, it's Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tite. Today on the show, our Project Milwaukee series continues. Researcher David Pate says more hard data is needed to solve the high rate of black male incarceration here. Later, what do you know about John Wilkes Booth's brother? Edwin Booth is still thought of as a groundbreaking actor.
He was an absolute innovator and incredibly contemporary and naturalistic, long before we ever needed the Russians to come over here and tell us how to act naturally. Edwin Booth was doing it.
And an impressive collection of works by Marc Chagall resides at UWM and inspires an art history student to better understand the artist.
He's not very interested in trying to dictate an acceptable moral code to his audience. He's not interested in moralizing his audience, but he's very interested in portraying human nature at its core.
Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tike. Thank you so much for tuning in today. WUWM and Milwaukee Public TV are in the midst of a comprehensive series on the issue of the high rate of incarceration among African-American men in Milwaukee specifically and in Wisconsin in general. There's some key statistics that drive the conversation, that more than half of black men in their 30s in Milwaukee County have spent time in prison, and that Wisconsin has the highest such rate in the country. But a researcher who looks specifically at how the issue is affecting Milwaukee says it's important to make some distinctions when we study the issue. David Pate is an associate professor in the Department of Social Work at UW-Milwaukee and our Real Talk contributor. He talked with Stephanie Lecce and offered some important context on the issue.
Well, you know, Wisconsin stands out as the worst of the worst, unfortunately, because for one, we do have a very high rate. And I think often we have to understand what rate and number means. People often think of rate as the number. Really what the rate is the percentage. Wisconsin has a 6% black population. However, we have a high rate of that 6% that's incarcerated. Where nationally, if you look at the white versus black, we're also three times the rate of those who are incarcerated. So again, it's important to understand that this rate is not the number, but it just means that proportionally it's a high rate.
So in essence, there are more white men in prison than black men in prison, but the rate proportionate to the population of black men in the state of Wisconsin is higher than that for the rate of white men.
Thank you, Stephanie. That's correct.
All right. Yeah. But then how do we fare? I mean, we've talked with a researcher from the Sentencing Project who says that Wisconsin's really actually following, even though our rate is so high, we're kind of following national trends when it comes to the incarceration of black men.
You're exactly right. The U.S. incarcerates more citizens and non-citizens at a higher rate than any other country on the planet. We have a very high incarceration rate. For example, if you look at this, at the Republic of China, they have people who have been who put in prison for human rights violations, but it's still much lower. We're still four times larger than China, and we're 0.3% or 66 times more higher than South Africa. So for some reason, we have this inclination to have more people put in jail for reasons that are nonviolent, that are very different.
Well, let's go into some of those reasons. I guess in this segment, I'd love to have you identify maybe the top five reasons that you've come across in your research as to why Wisconsin and Milwaukee's rate is so much higher than the national rate of black male incarceration. What is going on here in our backyard?
Well, what's really interesting is that I've done research on this topic for the last 20 years of black men, and it always comes up. I'll give an example. When I first started doing work with men in 1996 in Wisconsin, I would have three men raise their hand out of 12 men in my focus group who say I've been incarcerated for some issue. When I look at 2012, out of that same 12 men, I'll have 10 out of 12 who said they've been incarcerated. And I ask them, what is going on? Why is there so much more incarceration? Well, one, the job market has been much worse. So employment is definitely an issue for these men because they're trying to find a way to make ends meet. So they may start drug trafficking or they may not be able to pay their driver's license. Much of what the report has been talked about before from your previous guests who have been on the show about
the UWM report.
The UWM report, yes, thank you. The other reason is that they start out when they're young committing something, and then it becomes a cyclical issue. And so therefore, they're not really sure how to manage their lives. They may not have some of the social networks to give them a job. Education could be an issue. I'm not going to say all the educators out there haven't done their job, but I do think education does go in line with employment. That's one of the issues. Another issue for some of these men is just I think there is a fear of the black body. There's a fear of the black male. And I think that we have to really have a more candid conversation of what does that mean. I'm sure that some of the people who are listening will get upset about that issue. But I think it's something that we have to really go to. Why is it that all these black men are being incarcerated? Why is it an increasing number of black women being incarcerated? I think there's something to think about there. So employment, education, fear of black, the fear of the black body. I think, unfortunately, we have to deal with issues of race as a bigger issue as well, just the overall issue of racism and discrimination and prejudice and what does that mean. And I guess if I was to look at one last issue, I guess I have to say just we just don't have enough services around mental health as well as around just drug treatment. And people who are having some challenges are going to do some things that they wouldn't do if they didn't have those other resources to kind of help them to be what we call, quote unquote, normal and act in a more effective, efficient way.
Well, we've been looking at some of these factors that you've already mentioned. I guess I'd like to start with looking at what you just talked about, the drug issue. Do we have data on just how many of the black men who are incarcerated in the state of Wisconsin have committed drug offenses versus other kinds, maybe violent offenses? Do we know how it breaks down?
Well, about one third of the black men from Milwaukee County that have been imprisoned in the state of Wisconsin in the last 23 years had only nonviolent offenses on their records. And the UWM study even says that as well.
One third.
And so then if you look at that, this amounts to about 8,300 black men. Those with drug histories are about half as likely as others to also have violent offense histories. So, again, if you look at what's going on here, I think that, again, we're not dealing with the issue of drug treatment, but also it's so easy to get a drug that you can sling on the street. That's just the truth. And many of the young men I've talked to in much of my research will say, if I only had another option, I would do it. But then when I'm looking at my kid who needs food or my family who needs some assistance, I have to figure out what I'm going to do. And also when I don't see school as a real venture for me to stay in, I'm not really doing well there and it's not a good resource of any further outcome, why stay there?
Well, so let me ask you about that, because then that brings us into the conversation about economics and poverty. And we know that Milwaukee especially has a high rate of poverty, especially in the minority community.
Mm-hmm.
But is this a chicken or the egg conversation here, where there are fewer job opportunities, which leads to someone committing a crime? Or is it harder for someone to get a job because they have committed a crime?
It's really both, Stephanie. I really think, you know, when people say to me, you know, I'm trying to do better, I've been out, and even some of your previous guests, I heard the three men talk about their whole life story. And what they really were saying is, when I'm trying to do right, I can't because they look at my record. You know, we really are going to this place where we want to just make sure everyone has a perfect background and a perfect life. And that's unfortunate. That's not reality. So for many of these men, when they're trying to do good, we still persecute them or we still criticize them for actions they did earlier in their life. When they try to do right from the very beginning, there's not many doors open there. And there's been numbers of studies have shown where black versus white men have been treated very differently in their access to employment. That was one of the things I learned when I was in the UK for all these last weeks. They were very surprised at how we treat black and white men around this issue of employment. They don't understand why everyone doesn't have access to some kind of benefit. That's a whole nother conversation, a whole nother show. But the whole idea of having some available money so that you make a transition is a big deal. And also, when I think about my own kids, I'm worried about my own daughter getting a job who will have a master's degree at some point, who may have a PhD. Jobs are just not available for even the most educated people in our country, let alone the least educated. And we don't have the industry that was there before to be sure that people are able to take care of their families. I think it's something that we as a country have to really fight for and advocate for a better jobs program that our Congress and senators should be really thinking about.
We've talked on previous Real Talk segments about these studies that show that, you know, a black man and a white man who have the same kinds of credentials, the white man is so many more times likely to get a job than the black man. So even if you're starting out with a clean record, it's difficult to get employment.
Exactly. It's been very well documented. Is this a whole lot of other challenges that we need to deal with? Because, again, those men who are really trying after they've committed their crime and they've done their time, they still are having difficulty getting jobs. And I hear it consistently in every focus group that I do, that is a big problem for them.
One of the questions that I've had as we've done this series, and, you know, we did hear again from the researcher from the Sentencing Project that there really just isn't enough data to know, is whether Black men who commit crimes are being sentenced differently than white men. And I wonder what kind of impact that might be having on the rate.
Well, you know, the one big issue that I would put out to even all funders in particular is that we need more research and data on what really are the demographics of who is committing crimes and what is their sentencing process. We definitely have some research that's been done. It's spotty at most, but unfortunately we don't have enough research that gives us the demographics we need. For example, I always want to know, what is the demographics around child support? You know, who really owes it? In Wisconsin, we're able to get access to that, but nationally, you really can't get that data. A colleague of mine at the law school and I were looking at access to justice issues. We've been doing a comparison of two states, Illinois and Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, we will be able to get a lot richer data, but in Illinois, it'll be a little harder because they don't have access to those demographics. So the one thing that we lack really in this country around who is committing the crimes and what do they look like on a national basis is the national data, because most people are not keeping it and most researchers are not doing this work.
And even in the state of Wisconsin, you've said it's been difficult to get access to those numbers to really understand how the demographics break down.
It's difficult. You know, luckily for me, though, I'm an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty, where we're able to get that in the context of my research that I'm doing right now. So for me, I'll be able to, with really laying out what I really need, I should be able to get that. But again, for most people, it's not as available unless you are an affiliate and unless you're really doing this type of poverty research and unless you're interested. You know, you really have to be interested in wanting to know and find out really what are the demographics, what does it look like by race, gender, class, which means income, whether you're white or black, and whether you're a man or a woman. You want to know those information because it helps you to have a more informed discussion and a more informed decision that you're going to make.
And likewise, by offense, we know that, as you mentioned before, that statistic about how in Milwaukee County, a third of the men mm-hmm. who are in state prison or have been were there for drug offenses. But there's also that crossover with violent crime.
Exactly. One third of black men from Milwaukee County that are in prison in the state of Wisconsin in the last 23 years had only nonviolent offenses in their records. This amounts to about 8,300 black men. Is that the one you're referring to?
Yeah.
Those with drug offenses histories were about half as likely as others have had a violent offense history as well. And that's in the UWM report as well. You can find the information.
So then it's really difficult for us to know where violent crime plays into this. You know, one of the things I'm curious about is within this high rate, is it really just being driven by drug crimes or is it the crime rate increasing in general? What would you say is something else that's contributing to the high rate of black male incarceration in this city?
What I would say, and I've said this to other people too, when you have a hyper-vigilant look at people in a community where they do commit high crimes, people will say most of, like I think Chief Flynn had also said, most of my offenders, or a lot of our offenders, are black. Therefore, in those communities where people are feeling less safe, you're going to see why are you in the communities? Why are you being disorderly? And therefore, you may find that other things are going on, such as drug trafficking. And because our drug trafficking laws are so strong and so vigilant that you will be locked up and incarcerated because of this offense, that makes for a bigger issue for black men because that is unfortunately the main employer for a lot of poor black men in these communities. Is the only one that is going to give them a job is this person who is slinging drugs, who is providing that resource to them. And because for many of them, that's the one way they're able to feed their families. That's the bottom line. Many of these young men have told me in many groups that I don't like doing this because I'm on the job 24 hours a day and I'm always looking behind my back. It's not something they want to do. It's something they have no choice to do. And I think we have to give more options to everybody because many people don't have those same options in these many of these poorer communities. And also we've heard that we already know there's specific zip codes within this city. So therefore, we should be able to do something better.
What are some of the questions that you have, you know, in your research that you would like to see answered that we just don't have the data for?
Some of the questions I like to have answered in my research in particular is, what are the demographics? Who are the people committing the crimes? Who are the people that owe child support? What is the real opportunity to work in a city like Milwaukee? Can someone give me a really good economic analysis of what the jobs are, who is going to be their market, who is going to be their workers, and how can they sustain a family in this community? period? If we can answer some of that, it would be really helpful, because then we can make some better informed policy choices around how to help people in this city. People assume that people are going to be able to have a job when they graduate, and that's not the reality any longer. We need to have some real answers that answer some, to make some real choices around to help families.
So for you, is it frustrating to have this question in front of you? Why are so many, you know, why is the rate of black male incarceration so high, and feel like you don't have the data in front of you to be able to answer it well?
It's very frustrating, because I think that if we were to be honest about what is the reality of these families, we would be in a different place in this city, period. We're not doing real, we're not doing, having a real discussion, and we need to have that real discussion.
Well, David Pate, thank you so much for coming in and kind of helping us flesh out this issue.
I look forward to more conversations on this, Stephanie.
See you next month.
Okay.
Real Talk contributor David Pate is an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. He's the founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice. He spoke with Stephanie Lecce as part of our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison. You can find the other segments in that six-month series at WUWM.com. We'll have more of Lake Effect in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. Might seem crazy to talk about gardening right after the first real snow of the season has hit, but Lake Effect gardening contributor Melinda Myers would counter that a little snow and some single-digit wind chills shouldn't deter you. She's with us to talk about what you might accomplish in the late fall. Great to see you as always.
Thanks, Mitch. Always great to be here.
So we've had the first real snow of the season, but the chances are pretty good that that snow is going to melt and we'll see what's left of our gardens before the real snow starts to fall in December and January. Is there still stuff we can be doing in our yards?
You bet. Some of us are anxious to get things packed away and be done with the garden season. Some of us, myself included, have a few things left to get in the ground or do before it totally freezes and the snow blankets us for a month or more. So this is actually a great time to do some planting. You can get great deals at the garden center. Trees and shrubs are on sale. Bulbs are still available. And as long as you can dig in the ground, you can plant. Now, sometimes some of us have been known to chip through some frozen, crusty soil to get those bulbs in the ground. But it's a little bit easier if you don't wait that long. So really, take advantage of some of the sales. Get some of those things in the ground. Or let's say you couldn't resist, bought a bunch of plants, and you don't know where you're going to put them. You can heel them in, and you have two options. One is to dig trenches in a vacant part of your garden, and then you just set the pots in there, cover them with soil so the root ball is covered, the pot's covered, and that's a great way to store them. I used to do that a lot with my vegetable garden. Sheltered area, it was perfect. And then when that was full, I would move things to my patio between my garage and my house. Very sheltered. Push all those pots together, take some of my annual baskets and containers that I wasn't overwintering, but use those for insulation, set those around the pots, and then when it would snow, I'd cover them up with snow. A great way to take advantage of the sales, take advantage of, well, I know I want that, but I don't know where I'm going to put it, and have it in hand so as soon as you can get out there, get that garden set, you'll have the plants in hand, and then just supplement this spring because there's always some new and different things to add to the collection.
Let's talk about pruning. And as we were saying, the temperature's kind of gone up and down and up and down again. What's the point at which we should no longer be pruning our plants?
You know, late summer, early fall is the time to kind of avoid. Now that the leaves are dropped, things are going dormant. So if you want, this is a time you can really actually get started. I'm one of those people that likes to do a job once. So I like to wait till late winter. So if there's been snow or ice damage, deer or rabbit have come in and fed, kind of see what's left in late winter, do any, you know, clean up pruning to fix the problem. And then if I need to shape or do any kind of renewal pruning, the plants recover quickly because they'll start growing. And I kind of do it one time. It's a great time if you have fall bearing raspberries. I talked to somebody not too long ago who picked their last crop and just got done cutting them back. Fall bearing raspberries bear their crop on first year canes. So you can cut those right to the ground or leave them for the rabbits to chew to the ground or do it in late winter. cut those to the ground. Summer bearing, though, you want to leave the canes that didn't bear fruit yet standing and just take the old ones so the ones that had fruit this summer can go right back to the ground. Again, you could wait till late winter. If you want to get a jump start, good time to do it. I like to wait on the evergreens. You can prune them in the fall, but one of the things, if you think about evergreens, those needles that have been exposed, like on yews and junipers, to the wind, the sun, the drying temperatures, they're pretty tough. Underneath that are those that have been shaded and protected. You prune off the toughened needles, then you expose those tender ones. So it's better to do it in spring. Pines and spruces wait until spring to do that pruning.
So it's interesting. It dawns on me that I asked that question backwards. It's not really a question of should we stop pruning? The question is when should we start pruning?
Exactly. And that's a common misconception.
You think you're exposing the inside of the plant to freezing weather.
Exactly. So, you know, it's a good time when things are dormant. The old saying is when the saw is sharp. But then kind of look at your landscape. Look at the kind of problems you've had in the past and your schedule, too. When are you going to have time to do the work? And make sure you need to prune. Just because you do have a saw in hand doesn't mean your plants need to be pruned.
Well, Melinda Myers, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Melinda Myers is our regular gardening contributor. She's also the host of Melinda's Garden Moments on television and the author of several new books on gardening. We'll learn about those titles next week on Lake Effect. John Wilkes Booth gets all the press, but his brother was the better actor. A new play on the work of Edwin Booth will soon be performed in Milwaukee. We'll hear about it in just a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Teich. For anyone who knows even a little American history, the last name Booth will almost immediately bring to mind the man who killed Abraham Lincoln. But before, and well after, John Wilkes Booth fired that fateful shot, his family was known as America's theatrical royalty. Father Junius Brutus Booth began the dynasty, and long before there were movie matinee idols, Brother Edwin Booth was one. Edwin was also one of the greatest actors of his, or maybe any, generation. And it's on Edwin that Milwaukee actress and playwright Angela Iannone has focused her attention. Iannone just finished the third in a trilogy of plays about various real-life points in Booth's life and career. Called Irving and Booth in Othello, it finds Booth working in London in the early 1880s. The play will have a staged reading next week with Iannone herself playing English actress Ellen Terry and Simon Provan playing Edwin Booth. The two came to the studio to talk with Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and they started with a scene from the play.
And while you two gentlemen might have a loathing of rehearsals, I like to know what is expected of me. Like you, Mr. Booth, I have spent my life on the stage, and I have a high enough opinion of my art to know it is impossible to entirely upset me. It is, however, entirely possible to puzzle me. I prefer not to rely on spontaneity. Won't you allow me to rehearse with you?
It will not be an inconvenience?
It will not. There is a sadness in you, Mr. Booth. Mr. Stoker defined it as haunted.
Did he?
I find the word apt.
I am a call-bearer, Miss Terry.
I am not familiar with the term.
At my birth, I hope I will not offend.
I have two children, Mr. Booth. I am aware both of how they are made and how they are born.
At my birth, the membrane covered my head. It is said those born are so gifted.
In what way gifted?
Gifted to see ghosts.
Do you?
I am surrounded, night and day.
And is this a gift?
Sometimes. It depends on who visits. My father has been here today. He is not pleased with my lack of industry. Do you not come your tardy son to chide that lapsed in time and purpose? Let's go by the important acting of your dread command.
What command was that, Mr. Booth?
My father, gave me a sacred trust to continue his legacy.
What did he say?
Papa was never much of a talker, not off stage, not with me. He was asked once when I was with him, and I was always with him. He was asked to which of his sons he planned to pass his mantle.
Sons? I wasn't aware. I know, of course, of your younger...
Please, don't.
Oh, No.
Papa spoke of the three of us. My older brother Junius is also an actor of a sort. He might have been better or been happier if Papa had not been great. But my father was a great actor. And when Papa was asked, "To which of your sons do you pass your... which of your sons will inherit your..." he placed his hand upon my head. He had to reach up to do so. I was 14. I had made my acting debut as Tressel in Richard III only a few weeks before, and Papa was playing Richard. So you see, not in so many words, but it was enough for me.
This visitation is but to whet thy almost blunted purpose.
Yes. But better than that.
Oh. Angela Iannone and Simon Proven, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So who did we just hear? Obviously, Edwin Booth and...
and Miss Ellen Terry.
This scene.
Yes.
And this is the third of your plays, and we'll get to the whole trilogy
yes.
about this. But what did we just witness?
This is the third play in the Edwin Booth trilogy, and this one is called Irving and Booth in Othello. And it revolves around a very famous production of Othello that was done in London with Sir Henry Irving and Edwin Booth trading off the roles of Iago and Othello weekly. It was a 3-week run, and they traded off the roles between themselves. And Ellen Terry played Desdemona to both of them. And Edwin Booth was famous for hating to rehearse. He absolutely loathed it. And in this particular scene, Ellen comes upon him rehearsing by himself the Act 5 scene where Othello kills Desdemona, and she asks if she can rehearse with him. Henry Irving also didn't care to rehearse, although he would rehearse everybody else in the show, and then he would turn to Ellen and say, "Oh, you and I will be all right." So she's desperately trying to... will someone please tell me what it is you expect me to do? I mean, she had been born and raised on the stage and was very familiar with how to do stuff. But as she says, it's like, really, I would prefer to know what it is we're supposed to be doing together. So she convinces Edwin Booth, who hates to rehearse with her in this scene. But they're talking about Edwin's father, Junius Brutus Booth, who was a very famous actor in America. And Edwin was sort of the crown prince of theatrical royalty.
And, of course, he had the infamous brother,
yes.
John Wilkes.
Yes.
Yes. And whose name Edwin never mentioned. From the time of the assassination on, he did not allow his brother's name to be mentioned in his presence, and he didn't mention it either. So there's all sort of dancing around. Well, everyone knows about your brother, and he would...
That's it.
That's
no,
it.
Don't talk.
No, we're not going to say anymore.
And of course, John Wilkes, you know, you talk about ghosts in this scene. Mm-hmm. You know, he's of course one of the ghosts. And he
yes.
was, from what I understand, a brilliant actor.
He was a brilliant actor at melodrama, which was the predominant form of the time. But he didn't have the talent that Edwin had. He wasn't a Shakespearean. He wasn't a tragedian. But he was a very dashing, good-looking...
Charismatic.
Fellow. Charming
well,
young man.
Well, and Simon, for you, playing such a famous, wonderful actor as Edwin Booth, I mean, this must be a little bit daunting.
It is. It is. You know, when Angela first contacted me about it, I was driving, but I was literally, like, hopping up and down in my seat. I was very excited to do this. I had the privilege of seeing the first one at UW Whitewater. So it was not only daunting of fulfilling the role of Edwin, but having seen a great production and Jake Lesh, is
Jake Lesh.
You know, he was absolutely marvelous when I saw him. So there was also that as well. But, you know, with all roles, try to find ways that you can link into the role from your own personal life. And I've found ways to do that. The biggest help, though, has just been all the research that Angela has given to me. I know that Edwin was probably the best Hamlet that America has ever had.
Oh, there's no probably. Yeah.
Right.
even counting the difference in stage technique and acting technique?
Ah, well, here you come to it. Edwin was the first naturalistic actor and a huge proponent of the quote-unquote new natural style. When you read accounts of what he did, his stage business, his inflections, he was an absolute innovator and incredibly contemporary and naturalistic long before we ever needed the Russians to come over here and tell us how to act naturally. Edwin Booth was doing it. And one of the things that we did in the first play was recreate his performance of Hamlet, because we have eyewitness accounts. We have actually two of them, of different people who came and saw it time and time and time again and wrote it down and wrote down what he did. And when you look at it, when you bring it to life, it's absolutely contemporary. Because here is the thing. A great actor is always a great actor. You cannot lie to an audience. If he weren't great, we wouldn't still be talking about him. And the things that he did, absolutely brilliant, fearless innovations in how to play Hamlet. I don't think there's a contemporary actor working today who would have the guts to do what Edwin did with his Hamlet.
Like what? Can you give me
the
example?
The Ophelia burial scene, which is usually staged to focus on the Hamlet. He's downstage and he's in some place where he's lit so that they can see Hamlet grieving. Oh my gosh, it's Ophelia's body? Oh, I'm sad. Edwin did the entirety of that scene with the Horatio standing in front of him, and the only thing that was visible was his hand over Horatio's shoulder. So that when he discovers that it's Ophelia, all you could see was him clench his hand and then release it as he begins to grieve, and then he would slide down out of sight behind Horatio, who has his back to the audience. So the only thing that the audience could see was his hand working. Edwin was the first person in America to dim the lights in the auditorium so that the focus would be on the stage. He was the first person, the first actor ever to sit down during the to be or not to be speech. Because
really?
It made perfect sense to him. It's natural. The man is thinking. He's contemplating suicide. He's contemplating death. Why would you walk downstage center and stand there? It seemed perfectly natural for him to come into the room and sit. And that's, of course, that famous picture of him seated with his hand on his head.
Yes.
And that's why there are pictures of it, because it was such an amazing innovation, but perfectly natural.
So we would recognize him on stage today. I mean, if he were to show
we
up.
We wouldn't blink.
We wouldn't think, oh, this is kind of anachronistic or something.
No.
Interesting.
No. And there is a recording of his voice. There are actually several of them, but two of them they're on wax cylinders. Edison recorded them himself. And they're too degraded to touch. But there is a section of him speaking a speech from Othello that is available online and very easy to find. And it is the most contemporary, natural thing you've ever heard.
I was shocked when Angela sent me the link and I opened it up and This is not what I've been taught in theater history, and it's not what I've been teaching in theater history.
Right.
And that's part of it is, I'm so excited that Angela's doing this. The more I found out about it and find out about Edwin Booth, the more I want to bring this to my students and really get all actors to understand.
This is our heritage.
Exactly.
We don't have to look to the British. And I don't mean that in a bad way. We don't have to look to the British to teach us anything about how to do Shakespeare. You know, we don't have to look to them for our idols in terms of acting. And we don't have to look to the Russians to say, oh, we need to teach you about naturalistic acting technique. We were doing this long ago. And Edwin was absolutely on the forefront of that.
Now, at the time that this play that you've written is set, which is 1881 in London, had that standard been accepted in America? Had his standard, or was it later that really came
in? No, he was the thing.
He was the thing at that point.
He was it.
Yeah.
So what was he taking to London?
I'll let you
know,
answer.
And
well, that's the interesting thing. They didn't like him in Shakespeare.
Because he was too
He
natural.
Had a whole repertory of play, and he did his Hamlet. He did his Iago. He did his Othello. He did his Richard III. He did his Shylock, which they kind of liked. They liked him better in the two melodrama plays that were part of his repertory, The Fool's Revenge, which we know as the story from the opera Rigoletto about the hunchback. and Richelieu, which actually had been written for an English actor, William Charles MacCready. And Henry Irving had played it by the time Edwin was there doing it himself. But they actually liked him better in the two melodramas than they did in the Shakespeare, although they did say that he spoke beautiful, beautiful verse. And he did. He was an incredible verse speaker. You know, Henry Irving had kind of put his stamp on everything by that time. And it was the first time Edwin faced a rival, because he never had a real rival in his career. No one was ever as good as Edwin.
So that's why you've said it here.
Yes.
So we mentioned earlier this is the third in your Edwin Booth trilogy.
Yes.
So what prompted you to write plays about this and not just do research and not just do something scholarly?
Mm-hmm. Well, the flip answer is also the most true. I fell in love with Edwin Booth. I looked at this picture of him sitting in the Hamlet chair, and I fell in love. And then I said, I have to know who this man with the eyes is and with this amazing face. And the more research that I did, the angrier I got that he's been under the shadow of his brother for so long, and that American actors have no appreciation of what it was that he was doing. I really felt like he is American history. The 19th century was an astonishing time, and Edwin Booth was right in the middle of all of it. His father and he were friends of presidents. He was American theatrical royalty. He was an innovator in both acting technique and stage technique. I fell in love with Edwin Booth is the simple answer.
And one thing I want to say, from everything that I've been reading, I don't think Edwin ever decided, hey, I'm going to do this, like consciously decided I'm going to do this naturally. I don't think he could do it any other way. He's known for playing Hamlet. Hamlet is haunted by his father. Edwin is haunted in his life. Mm-hmm. This was the only way he could do it.
Playwright and actress Angela Iannone and actor Simon Provan spoke with Bonnie North about the third play in Iannone's Edwin Booth trilogy called Irving and Booth in Othello, produced by Milwaukee's Goats and Monkeys. It will have two staged readings at the 10th Street Theater in Milwaukee next week, Monday and Tuesday at 7:30. Admission is free at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. You can hear the wax cylinder recording of Edwin Booth performing a scene from Othello. One last break, and then the story of a remarkable collection of work by Marc Chagall, which happens to be housed in Milwaukee. That's in just a moment as Lake Effect continues on WUWM. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Teich. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee has many treasures on its campus, but perhaps one of the lesser known is the collection of fine art held by the Art History Department. The department has a gallery in Mitchell Hall that holds regular exhibits, and students are free to work with the prints and paintings to advance their studies. Among the holdings is a significant number of original prints by the Russian-Jewish artist Marc Chagall, and it was those works that intrigued master's student Cassie Sackett. Her thesis project, called The Morals of Marc Chagall, is hanging now in the department's gallery and comprises of almost three dozen original etchings and lithographs. Sackett recently met Bonnie North at the gallery and explained why she chose this artist.
Well, I knew I wanted to work with Marc Chagall, and as an undergraduate, I worked with the Dead Souls Suite, and so I was very familiar with that, but I wanted to expand it as my thesis exhibition and really look further, and I was looking at our collection here at UWM and came up with the idea that each of these texts that I'm dealing with deals with morals quite heavily. So I wanted to see how Chagall dealt with those morals, how he understood them and wanted to interpret them.
Which morals are we talking about specifically?
Good morals versus bad morals. He's not very interested in trying to dictate an acceptable moral code to his audience. He's not interested in moralizing his audience, but he's very interested in portraying human nature at its core, which obviously involves a lot of morality, whether it be good or bad.
Where did all of these wonderful prints come from?
Every print in this exhibit comes from the UWM art collection. They have had donations throughout the years, and there have been a few different donors who have donated this work, and it's been really amazing having it available to work with, to be able to view and study right on hand.
And these are originals, right? We're not talking about prints of prints.
They are originals. They are prints, but they are original prints. They have signatures, some of them. We have the entire book of the story of the Exodus with the text and everything. It's a really great piece. We even have more than I included in the exhibit. I tried to narrow it to the morals, the idea of the morals, but we do have at least one more illustrative text suite.
So let's look at some of the pieces. We start with black and white. So what is the first piece you chose and why?
The first piece that I chose is from the Dead Souls suite. The Dead Souls was the first of the three suites that he created. In this exhibition, we have the Dead Souls, the Fables of La Fontaine, and the Story of the Exodus. So Dead Souls was created in the early 1920s. And yes, they are all black and white etchings. And the first image is Farewell to Manilov from Chichikov. And it is actually the two men making a deal to purchase dead serfs or souls. The main character has this scheme, and everyone in the Dead Souls suites is very immoral.
And they're all scheming.
They're all scheming, yeah. And they're all giving in to Chichikov's plot because they can get something out of it as well. They don't necessarily always know that they're acting immorally, but they know that they're not doing the right thing as well. So this is after the first deal has been made. The men are shaking hands in agreement of the deal, and Chichikov is on the right and basically elated. He's jumping up in the air, basically, because he's so happy that he's successfully made his first deal. But Manilov, on the other hand, is very confused. He doesn't understand what the implications of selling dead souls will do. And so his head is very small, and that reflects his confusion.
Yeah, he looks as if he's almost shrinking.
Yes. And I think all of the settings in Dead Souls are supposed to be very chaotic, and the perspective is upturned, and it's supposed to make you feel anxious. And I think this piece, again, does that incredibly well.
Yeah, it's actually, when you look at it, it's kind of tilted.
Exactly.
You know, nothing seems to be on a level playing ground.
Exactly. Yeah.
So as we move through these etchings, this is all on this wall from
yes.
the same collection?
Yep, I used the walls to separate out the suites.
The first one is very, simple lines, mm-hmm. and we start to get more and more coloration as we go through a lot more detail, even mm-hmm. though it's still black and white.
Right.
Was that something that he was exploring artistically as well, or is it showing up because that's how you set it up?
I think that he does a very good job of keeping minimal lines throughout, but he does play very well with heavy images and very light images. I guess most of these ended up being heavy images because I was trying to tell the audience something specific with these images and just trying to highlight the immoral character of these people.
I love, the fact that they're etchings, yet it almost looks like he's hand-painted them with ink. And, of course, it's just part of his mastery.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
In the Fables of La Fontaine, they are also etchings, but they are actually hand-colored. So Chagall went through and hand-colored each of them. And he did this because originally these pieces were made with gouache, which is a type of water-based paint. So they are very colorful, and they are all originals. And then he created the etchings based off of those gouaches, and they wanted to make them colored etchings, but unfortunately the color just wouldn't translate over to the medium, and they ended up having to do black and white etchings, and then 85 of the suites got hand color.
Yeah, and it's just actually the layering is quite beautiful. I'm looking at the one of the two women, and you get the suggestion of the colors of their dresses.
Exactly. He really was very successful in trying to recreate this building up of paint in his etchings. And they do have a very different visual quality than the Dead Souls prints.
They do, very much. And is this later? Was he doing this at a later time?
This was actually done immediately after the Dead Souls were finished. So the Fables of La Fontaine started in 1927, and that's the same year that the Dead Souls prints were completed.
Was he moving away from or moving toward a different kind of expression at this point, or is this a transitional phase for him artistically?
Very much a transitional phase. With the Dead Souls suite, he really created it because he had a negative experience in Russia with the Russian Revolution. He became a commissar of arts, and within 2 years of having that position, he was ultimately exiled from Russia forever. And Russia is his homeland, and he's very, very much dedicated to the iconography of Russia throughout his career, even though after 1920, he never returns. So the Fables of La Fontaine were created while he was in France, and France became his new homeland, and he really stayed there for as long as he could. He stayed there for the rest of his life, except for during World War II, in which case he was in America for a few short years.
Yeah, and I would think that everything that happened with the Russian Revolution would have influenced that idea of morality as well.
Exactly. It is very much the prompting of him creating this Dead Souls suite is the Russian Revolution and his negative experience. He was really wanted to portray how he believed Russia was acting in that moment.
So as we look at the Fables of La Fontaine, where this is all on one wall, for the first time, I think, I'm looking back, there are some animals in the first collection in the Dead Souls, but now we actually have one etching here that is nothing but animals.
Yes, the Fables of La Fontaine, like Aesop's fables, are largely based in animal fairy tales. So they are mischievous animals who speak to each other and usually have some sort of tricky behavior going on.
Representing humans, of course.
Exactly, always representing humans. There are a few of the stories that have humans as well, but most of them are animal-based.
Okay, so now we move to the third and final wall of the exhibition, which is the story of Exodus, of the Exodus. And this is familiar to pretty much anyone who's of a Judeo-Christian background. Okay. And so what was he trying to do here? And these are all color. Every one of these prints is in full color.
Mm-hmm. These prints are not etchings. They are lithographs, and that's why they get to be all color. And Chagall was really trying to maintain a universal message in his depiction of biblical themes, and many of his biblical themes, not just the story of the Exodus. And he really does maintain a universalist message of the moral stature of the characters in the text. And he does this through the use of an emotionally rich humanity. So in this first image of Moses looks upon the toiling Israelites, Moses has his hands on his heart and his face is sort of squinched in this very compassionate, caring expression. And he feels that way because he's looking upon the Israelites, who are his family, basically, and they are toiling under the enslavement of the Egyptians.
Yeah, you see there's a little pyramid up
exactly.
in that corner, and they're carrying heavy burdens.
Yes, yeah. And I basically interpret it as they are literally carrying their burden of slavery on their back.
And then we move to
a lesser-known part of the story, which is after the parting of the Red Sea, after the Israelites escape. They're in the desert and searching for their promised homeland. And in celebration of their escape, Miriam, who is, I believe, the sister of Aaron, dances in celebration with timbrels, or what I would think we would call tambourines nowadays. And they are joyously dancing in celebration of God and of Moses' miraculous parting of the sea. And this image actually is very key to my argument in the story of the Exodus, because while Chagall maintained a universalist message of the moral character of the people in the text, he also very much used a lot of Jewish iconography and ideas and themes to enhance his images. So in my research of the story of the Exodus, I found out that in Jewish culture, a lot of celebrations and religious holidays are celebrated with dance, with celebratory dance, and that's specific to the Hasidic that Chagall grew up with. In portraying this celebratory dance, Chagall is probably envisioning the rituals that he saw as a child and recreating them in this ancient scene.
Was he religious in his later life?
He was not religious. He did not practice Judaism at all in any form, but he was very, very aware of his Jewish identity. He never shied away from trying to promote Judaism. He was very much an advocate of having a Jewish museum for artists and that sort of thing, and very much uses Judaism in his own personal iconography.
So we get to the end of the last few prints here, and what I find interesting is you ended with continuing Exodus.
Yes, this is actually the last image of the suite. So this is also what Chagall ended with. It shows the continuing Exodus, so obviously they have not reached their promised homeland yet, but they will eventually. Chagall depicts both modern and biblical Jews. And in doing this, he's trying to parallel the story of the Exodus with the modern story that he witnessed of the founding of Israel in 1948.
So this was done when? When was this?
1966.
So quite late in his career.
Right.
So as far as Chagall was concerned, the Exodus continued.
The Exodus did continue, and Chagall was very much a proponent of Zionism and the founding of Israel. And I believe that the whole suite of the story of the Exodus should really be seen as a statement of support for Israel from Chagall. And I believe that he sees the story as a modern interpretation of the founding of Israel.
So what do you hope that people who come to look at this exhibit take away from it?
I hope that they take away that, like I said earlier, Chagall is really interested in portraying human nature at its core. He's really interested in trying to get at the emotionality of people and how that might affect them. And like I said earlier, too, he's not trying to dictate an acceptable moral code. He's not trying to moralize his audience or tell people that they're not leading the correct life, but he's just trying to portray human nature.
Well, they are certainly beautiful, beautiful prints, and I'm sure most of us have never seen other than maybe in books. And I want to thank you so much for putting it together, of course, but for talking with me this morning, Cassie. I appreciate it.
Thank you, too.
Cassie Sackett is a master's student in art history at UWM. Her thesis project is called The Morals of Marc Chagall, and the exhibition of Chagall's etchings and lithographs is on display at the UWM Art History Gallery through December 12th. The gallery is open Monday through Thursday. You can find more information about the hours, the UWM Art History Department, and its collection from links at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Sackett spoke with Bonnie North on site at the gallery. That's Tuesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Tomorrow on the show, another rapid advance in genome science is playing out in Milwaukee, plus what's behind the trend towards smaller restaurant portions. Great to have you with us today, as always, and I sure hope you'll listen again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Fresh air is next. Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock.